Hello gamers, this is Maverick, and you're listening to The Limit Break. This week's episode is very special and historic, not only for The Limit Break, but for all of KJCC. Coming up is our exclusive full-hour Skype interview with acclaimed video game composer and developer Tommy Tallarico. Also, stay tuned after the interview for my exclusive review of Mario Super Sluggers from the Nintendo Wii.
Yo, Maverick.
What's going on?
Is that like Maverick as in like the fighter pilot? Or
everyone says that. Maverick? I think it's a little bit of everything.
Okay, cool.
I don't know if you can hear me too well in the microphone.
I can hear you okay. Or cool. Is it Maverick like John McCain Maverick? I don't know. What are you talking about?
Well, I'm a huge wrestling fan, so it's Jeff Jarrett's brain Maverick at the moment.
Okay, fair enough.
All right, so first off, I want to know how Video Games Live came to be, and what's your background?
Yeah, well, I've been a video game composer for over 18 years, and have worked on over 300 video games, actually, which is insane.
That's awesome.
long time. And
he's a veteran.
But you know, my whole idea and concept was that I wanted to kind of prove to the world how culturally significant and artistic video games have become. So we created Video Games Live in order to, we wanted to create a show for not just hardcore gamers, but a show where you don't have to know a darn thing at all about video games to come out to the show and really be entertained. So, you know, Video Games Live takes live, huge, you know, local live symphonies and choirs. But what makes it really unique and special is that we completely synchronize all of the music and everything to the live players to huge video screens, to rock and roll lighting and special effects and stage show production, interactive elements with the crowd. So I kind of like to describe Video Games Live as having all the power and emotion of a symphony orchestra combined with the energy and excitement of a rock concert mixed together with all the technology, cutting-edge visuals, interactivity, and fun that video games provide.
I have a question. Do people sometimes get confused in how, like, sometimes they think it's the game audio only, and sometimes they think you're not really playing it? Or do you have all the instruments louder than than what you see on the screen? Like, do you make a whole, like, a full show production out of it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's a show, first and foremost. You know, it's not, we don't consider ourselves just a concert. You know, I mean, we're a complete celebration of the video game industry. So, you know, things like the pre-show festivals, we have, you know, costume contests and prize giveaways and game competitions. Uh-huh. And game demos, and we have meet and greet with famous local game developers, and we'll bring in game composers from all over the world to meet the audience as well. But in terms of the actual music and stuff itself, our goal is to recreate the music from the games in the best way possible, and then even go beyond that and bring it even more live. So, you know, bringing it more to what people have come to expect in the game. So, you know, some of game music, it's not just traditional symphony. You know, some game music like Halo has, you know, huge percussion and drum beats, or Metal Gear Solid will have, drum beats and drum loops, and things like Tron have synthesizers in it. And, you know, we do like rock and roll versions of like Castlevania or Final Fantasy VII.
Oh, you there? Hello?
There's one more to it. We don't want to be looked at or viewed as, oh, it's just a symphony, upper-class symphonic show, and everybody's wearing tuxedos, and shh, everybody be quiet because the symphony's about to play, and don't clap through the music. You know, we're the exact opposite of that. And there are video game concerts out there that you know, portray gaming and the music like that. And that's, you know, as a game composer, I think that's fantastic. And I mean, they've been doing that in Japan for over 20 years, you know, putting on more classical type of shows with video game music. But that's definitely not us, and not what Video Games Live is about. Because again, we want to make this show for everyone, not just people who normally go to a symphony or not just like hardcore gamers. We want to make the show for every single person, whether you're an 8-year-old girl or an 80-year-old grandma. You know, those are the numbers that we get after the finish are from the non-gamers or from the, because, you know, the gamers get it. You know, we know the music to Halo and Warcraft and Final Fantasy and Kingdom Hearts is great. We already know that, right? So to hear that in a live thing is a very emotional thing for a lot of people.
And then you add the rock and roll element in there, too, which is awesome.
But getting a letter from a grandparent going, oh my gosh, I never knew video game music was this incredible, and I never knew that characters and the storylines were so intense and the graphics were so amazing. I get it now. I know why my kids or grandkids are so much into video games. And those emails we get more than anyone else. We'll get about 50 or 100 emails like that every time we do a show from the non-gamers. About 30 to 40% of our audience doesn't play video games. You know, so I think, you know, bringing it to the world is an important goal. And as well, we're ushering in a whole new generation of people to see a symphony. I mean, that's cool as well. But our main focus was, you know, to bring this to the masses and the mainstream.
Now, a lot of people still think that video game music is a bunch of bleeps and bloops, like, for example, Pac-Man.
Yep.
Where do you think the line was crossed from that 8-blip sound all the way into like the full 5.1 surround sound? That was one of the questions I had.
How did the evolution of video game music start?
Like, from, like I said, the 8-bit bloops to the full 5.1 surround sound.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I first started out in the industry, that's what we had to work with, were, you know, archaic sound chips and, you know, programming and code and things like that. And, you know, it was really in the and reality was back then, you know, mostly there was no such thing as a game composer. It was just a game programmer who was interested in music and who would type in notes in a computer keyboard, you know. But some of the greatest music of our time was created back then in the 80s, you know. Iconic music like Mario and Zelda and Castlevania and Metroid, and you just played some Pac-Man there. And the reason that was, it was very short and you didn't have much to work with, so you had to rely just on melody alone. That's all you had to go with, so you better have written a really awesome, catchy tune, you know. But then what happened is in the mid-90s, the industry really started to change when CD-ROMs became available as a storage medium for games. So all the barriers now were kind of, you know, washed away. Now we could record live musicians and live orchestras and, you know, live guitars and drums or whatever. But it still took about 4 or 5 years after that, even, for video game soundtracks to really come into their own. And the reason for that was that although CD-ROMs were available in like 93 and 1994, the reality was is that the budgets weren't up to speed with the technology. So it was really the turn of the century where you started to see, you know, great scores like, you know, Medal of Honor and the God of Wars and the Final Fantasies and Halos and Warcraft and, you know, the list goes on and on and on, Myst and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's come such a long way. I mean, you know, you take something like Metal Gear Solid, you know, what would that have sounded like in the 80s? You know, it wouldn't have been as dramatic as it is now. So, you know, luckily the technology caught up to us.
Okay. Since you mentioned how technology didn't catch up with the budget until about 3 or 4 years after the CDs were made. If gaming music today needed work, where do you think it would need to be, like, touched up a bit in some areas?
I think that sometimes, I mean, it really depends. I mean, there's so many different, you know, there's no such thing as, like, you know, video game music and what it sounds like. You know, I mean, it's not like a genre of music in that rock and roll is guitar, bass, drums, maybe some synth and some vocals. You know, blues has its own distinctive sound. You know, video game music doesn't have a distinctive sound. It's all of that combined. It's, you know, sometimes it's symphonies, sometimes it's orchestras and guitars mixed together, sometimes it's rock and roll, sometimes it's techno electronica. You know, it really, really depends on the game and on the genre of game. So the way you approach a first-person shooter would be completely different than the way you would approach, say, a fighting game or a driving game or a sports game,
right,
or you know, a situation like that. So you know, I would say that, you know, it's, you know, sometimes when doing a lot of games, one of the things that I notice is that, you know, people kind of rely maybe a little too much on the technology and the liveness of it all. And, you know, really at the end of the day, it still all comes down to a great melody, to a great motif, as we say in the composing world. You know, like you know, John Williams, for example, in the film world is the master of that. And Beethoven and Mozart, you know, 300 years ago were the masters of it back then, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so it's all about that catchy phrase, you know, whether it's Raiders of the Lost Ark or Star Wars or E.T., you know, the most important element is that motif and that catchphrase, if you will, musical catchphrase, that you can really go off of. So, you know, some of the games today, you know, you think about Halo and you think of that great opening, monk chant, you know, and that's a great catchy motif that they can use throughout the franchise. It's become the sound of the franchise. Everybody knows Mario and Zelda, and, you know, those, everyone can hum the theme from Tetris and all that kind of stuff. So it's, you know, I'd like to see more games, you know, really focus on that. If I had to say, you know, where could we improve, is, you know, let's create a theme for each game for the whole franchise and then carry that over, you know.
Now, how did you, Tommy, get into video game composing?
Well, my whole life, my two greatest loves were always video games and music. And, you know, I grew up in the 70s and the 80s. So I was really the first generation of people to grow up on video games. And, you know, I can remember when I was about 10 years old, I used to go down to the arcade and I would record all my favorite video game music on cassette tape. And I'd come home and record my Commodore 64 and my Apple II and my Intellivision and my Atari 2600. And I'd splice the tape together and invite the neighborhood kids over. And I'd charge them a nickel. And
nice.
I'd play the tape. I'd grab a broomstick and play air guitar in front of the television. And I'd put up my favorite video game images and games up on the TV. So I guess those were the first video game concerts back in 1977.
The foundings of Video Games Live, right there.
I always loved gaming and music, but again, there was no such thing as a video game composer back then. So I always wanted to do music, and I grew up on the East Coast in Massachusetts. And when I turned 21, I left my family crying on the doorstep, my mom and dad and brother, and I went to California because that's what you do if you want to be a professional musician. So I got in my car. I had no money, no job, no place to stay, no friends, nothing. Just all alone, got in my car, drove 3,000 miles to California by myself. And when I first got there, the only thing I really knew was Hollywood. So I got to Hollywood and took a look around, and if anyone's ever been to Hollywood, they know this to be true, but it's kind of a dump these days.
Yeah, oh yes, you know, I've been there.
Gosh, what the hell is this? I've been bamboozled. You know,
it's
where's,
not like
where's
TV.
All the fancy cars and the pretty women in the palm trees?
Yeah,
and,
really.
The only other thing I knew in California was Disneyland, so I literally stopped a homeless person on the street. I asked him where Mickey Mouse lived. Thought that'd be a pretty cool place to hang out. And he pointed me down to Orange County. So I'm driving into Orange County. This is the first day I was in California.
Uh-huh.
Driving into Orange County. And I see the palm trees and the pretty girls and the fancy cars and the beaches and all that stuff. And I said, oh, okay, this is what I envision California to be like. I'll just pick up a newspaper. I'm close enough to LA and the whole music scene to still be close to it. And so I picked up a newspaper and I saw a job for selling keyboards at Guitar Center, a big popular nationwide guitar shop.
Yeah.
So I went down there the next day. Now I was homeless too. The first 3 weeks I was in California, about 2-3 weeks, I was living underneath a pier at Huntington Beach. Didn't have any money or place to stay or nothing. But the first day I picked up a newspaper, went down there the next day to get this job. They hired me on the spot and they say, you start tomorrow. So this was 1990. And I went down there, and the TurboGrafx 16 is just coming out. And I actually had a T-shirt, a video game T-shirt, a TurboGrafx. So I was so into video games. And back then, no one had video game T-shirts. In fact, the way I got this T-shirt was at a country fair, a county fair. The previous summer, I stood in line for like 4 hours to play, I don't know, Altered Beast or some damn thing, and they gave me this T-shirt. I was like a game tester at the fair. And so I wore that shirt, and the very first person who walked in that day, the first person I waited on in the store happened to be a producer at Virgin, and they were starting a company called Virgin Mastertronic, which later changed their name to Virgin Games and then later to Virgin Interactive. But I was like the 10th employee ever hired. He saw my shirt, and he said, hey, do you want to have a job playtesting video games? Will pay you $6 an hour.
Nice.
And and I was hired. So I was in California 3 days, and I was in the video game industry, and that was almost 19 years ago now. But crazy. So I was hired as a games tester for the first couple months, and I'd always bug the guy, the vice president of the company. I said, look, whenever you need music, let me know. I'll do it for free. You know, if you don't like it, you don't have to use it. And luckily for me, the very first project we were working on internally was the original Prince of Persia. And did a soundtrack for there. My approach was very different. I didn't want it to be bleeps and bloops. I wanted it to, you know, to sound like a real score. And, you know, we didn't have to have 45-second happy looping music throughout the whole thing. You know, why not make the score, you know, maybe when he takes out his sword, let's play some music. Or when a door opens, let's play some music. Or he drinks a potion or he dies. You know, let's have specific areas for music. And let's not make it merry-go-round.
Like ditties, your,
you know, like little childlike
games,
ditties. Let's make it, you know, serious music.
Dramatic.
And, even though it sounds like bleeps and bloops, it doesn't have to, you know, you don't have to write it in, you know, C major. You know, let's use Middle Eastern type of chord progressions and things like that. So it was very different at the time, and the game did well. And after that, they made me the full-time music guy.
Awesome. Now, I heard during the past few years, I heard that you worked with Greedy Productions, correct?
Yeah. Well, I mean, myself and Victor Lucas, we created the show Electric Playground, which was the very first video game show. It was the first worldwide distributed video game show, but it was also the very first video game show that focused on the actual game creation and game developers and game publishers. It was, you know, somewhat of a news magazine. So we started that in 1993, and I think we hit the airwaves in 95 was the first show, in 94, 95. And then we also did another show called Judgment Day in the States, but it's called Reviews on the Run. And both those shows are still going, and we still film them. I don't have much time to film those shows these days because of the tour. But when I do have time, I try to get over there. But yeah, it's been like 14, 15 years now.
I'm still a huge fan of those shows. I mean, whenever I'm able to catch them, I watch them. I haven't watched them lately because they're not on G4 anymore.
What?
And I don't know if I get fused.
You know, it's funny. People think that G4 canceled the show, and actually what happened is our contracts ended and we decided not to renew them. So
that's what I thought it was.
we just didn't like the direction the G4 was going, and
I don't either.
The funny thing is we're actually still on G4 up in Canada, because the Canadian G4 is much different than here in the U.S. So
really?
the G4 Canada is a lot more like Tech TV used to be, and the way G4 used to be in the beginning.
But, oh yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know if you can steal cable from Canada here in the U.S. Do it up.
I still have most of your episodes of Judgment Day on VHS, and I watch them
Oh, there you go. You got to digitize those and put them up on YouTube for everybody.
Oh, that'd definitely.
There you go.
Oh, definitely.
But I've been watching that. I've also watched Jeff Keighley on Game Trailers TV on Spike TV, and I like him, too. I mean, he's one of the better ones that I've... Aside from you, of course, but yeah.
Yeah, no, no. In fact, Jeff Keighley will tell you the first job he ever got on television was from me and Vic. Me and Vic hired Jeff to be a reporter type for Electric Playground. That was his first gig ever on television.
All right. Well, first off, ladies and gentlemen, this is KJCC 104.1 FM, and you're listening to Tommy Tallarico with... And a complete interview with Tommy Tallarico, co-creator of Video Games Live. And this is Suzaku.
And Maverick.
And this is The Limit Break. All right. Now, what? Why did G4 turn into a Spike TV clone? Why did it deviate from its original content?
They didn't deviate it from what I've seen. They just minimized it.
Yeah, well, I have a couple theories about that. I mean, first off, the people who were running the network, I don't think were gamers. I don't think that they put enough enough credit into having hosts and shows for gamers by gamers. I think they felt that just hire anyone if it's a pretty face and they can read off of cue cards. I think that and you can't fool gamers. I think the reality is that one of the reasons why Judgment Day and Electric Playground were the top rated shows on the network when we were there is because I think it was kind of it was kind of clear that me and Vic were gamers and we didn't read off a script. We just turned the cameras on and started yapping. I think that there's a lot to be said about credibility and the intelligence of gamers. So I think that was one reason. The second reason is that I think they felt that they wanted to appeal to a wider mainstream audience, kind of like what I was saying a little earlier with Video Games Live, how we want to try to reach out not just go for gamers, but to reach out into a more to the non-gaming mainstream, or well, games are mainstream now, but back then not as much, but so I think they tried to model themselves after a Spike TV and brought on other shows like Cops and this and that, and I think the only game show really left is X-Play.
Yeah.
Maybe one or two more, but yeah, they really kind of wanted to. I think they got afraid. I think they created a bunch of shows that were subpar gaming shows.
Right. They have Code Monkeys on there,
the
but that was
weren't good because those shows were subpar. I think they got afraid and said, "Geez, nobody wants to watch a video game TV. Let's add a whole bunch of mainstream stuff like Cops and The Man Show and stuff like that."
Can I say, Tommy? Sorry, Tommy.
Anyway, but I think it's a shame because what would have show and where would the network be today if they would have created great video game television shows? So I really don't think that that great video game television has been realized yet.
All right. Well, hang on for a second. For those of you listening out there, I got some announcements for you for the rest of October. On October, 25th, there's going to be a free concert at Rasputin Music. It's going to be the last one because they're not going to be doing it anymore. On Thursday, October 30th, there's the KJCC Halloween Musical Masquerade. Come on by and dress up as your favorite Halloween characters or something like that.
And you'll get to see me there, too. I'll be there.
All right, Blue Meanie. And lastly...
Not this year.
On Sunday, November 2nd, is a Just for Laughs.
Let me see.
It's a free performance. Three short comedies at the College Theater.
Three short comedy plays. It's good.
Okay, and all right, let's see here. We already went. What do you see as the next big thing for the video game industry in terms of music?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, you see the, you know, the massive success of stuff like Rock Band and Guitar Hero, which is great because it's, you know, it's getting a whole new generation of people interested, and non-gamers as well, interested in video games and interested in classic rock music and, you know, stuff like that. I think you're seeing video games become the radio of the 21st century. I think you're seeing video games becoming the distribution channel of music for the 21st century. You know, you take a couple weeks ago, Guitar Hero Metallica was released. So Metallica released a brand new album,
and they
released it as a CD in the stores and on iTunes. But on the same day, they released it in Guitar Hero as well. So, and they made more money off the video game than all the other stuff combined. So I think that that says a lot about, you know, the power of video games as a distribution channel, as a means of people getting new music.
And the interactivity.
Like, and I think that's only the beginning, you know. I mean, that just happened recently. I think you're going to see a lot more of that moving ahead.
Yeah, I remember at the when you were here in San Jose, you had Sweet Emotion playing. You had Sweet Emotion, and I think that was a
that was great.
That was a wonderful choice.
And I also, you also mentioned Metallica releasing their tracks. Also, I just want to let everyone know AC/DC is also putting out a track pack exclusively to Walmart now that their new album is released. Black Ice is out now. Which is awesome.
Absolutely.
If you're looking for the Nuge, you can catch his Catch Scratch Fever on Guitar Hero Aerosmith, well as a Stranglehold on Guitar Hero World Tour. Now, I'm a little curious, Tommy. Did you work on Guitar Hero Aerosmith with Steven Tyler?
Well,
awesome.
Some may say that that I helped to put that entire deal together. So in regards to working on it in that sense, in fact, if you go back and you look at Guitar Hero 2, you'll see Aerosmith appearing in Guitar Hero for the first time, was in Guitar Hero 2. They weren't in the original one. And you also see a special thanks to Tommy Tallarico in the credits.
There you go.
They may have something to do with each other. But, yeah, you know, when the first Guitar Hero came out, of course, for the folks who probably don't know, that Steven Tyler, his real name is Steven Tallarico, and he's my cousin. And so when Guitar Hero, the original one, first came out, and before it blew up big, I'm good friends with the guys at Harmonix and Red Octane, were the original developers of the game, and Red Octane, the publishers. And they were like, and they knew of my connection with Steven. They said, man, you know, we tried to get Aerosmith in, and the record company wanted too much money. I'm like, dudes, send me some freaking Guitar Heroes and let me put them in Joe Perry's hands and Steven Tyler's hands, and I'll send them to my buddies, you know, Dweezil Zappa and Eddie Van Halen and Steve Vai, and
there
you know, we'll get these guys all behind it. And I remember, and so they sent me like 6 or 7 units, and I sent them out to all my friends, and I actually brought them with me when I was down in I think it was Florida or Tampa, Florida, where I was where Aerosmith was playing, and I happened to be in Florida at the same time, and you know, I remember showing it to Steven and Joe, and actually Lenny Kravitz was also in the room, and he got hooked immediately.
I can see Lenny Kravitz getting into
you know,
it.
And the first question out of Steven's was, where the hell's Aerosmith? How come we're not in here? I'm like, exactly. That's why I'm here. That's why I'm here. You guys got to get in this.
We're on the radio.
I had Harmonix. I hooked Harmonix directly up with Steven's management and Aerosmith's management. And they were in for number two. And, you know, I remember Joe Perry asking me, man, do you think they do a whole game on Aerosmith? You know, what if they do a whole game based on Aerosmith? I'm like, geez, I don't know. I mean, that's, you know, hey, let's ask, right? And I told him, I said, look, I think that something that's really important is if you guys really showed your commitment to the project. You know, I mean, one thing I've learned in the video game industry is, you know, when Hollywood, you know, people talk about movie licenses and this and that, and, you know, the times when the games are actually live up to the movie license is when, you know, the game publisher can have access to everything related to the movie and the actors and the whole thing. You know, Lord of the Rings is a perfect example. You know, right. Peter Jackson was working directly with EA. Peter Jackson loved video games, and he, you know, always, you know, so he gave everybody full access to everything, you know, and I think the games reflected that. And so, you know, same thing with Aerosmith. I said, look, you know, guy, if you guys are willing to, you know, really do some stuff and not just attach your name to it. And they're like, no, hell no. Yeah, we want to do everything. You know, Steven's like, I want to do the motion capture. I want to do this. I want to do that, you know? So, so yeah, it was really cool. And, you know, they made more money off of Guitar Hero Aerosmith than any other albums before that. So that, again, that'll, the video game made more money than the albums. So I think that's another telling sign of the power of video games.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, we're on the radio, so anything that comes out of our mouths goes straight to the listeners.
Just saying.
All right. Now, what would you say is the best example of the ultimate video game soundtrack?
Well, that's easy. That'd be our first album, Video Games Live Volume 1.
there you go.
It was released earlier this summer on EMI because it's a compilation, of course. You know, so I'll answer that twice. I'll plug the album a little bit.
It's the very first album to ever have.
To be a compilation album distributed worldwide by a major record label. So we have everything from Castlevania to Halo to Kingdom Hearts, you know, Myst, Tetris, all on the CD. But which was great about the album is when it was released, it was actually it debuted on the Billboard charts at number 10.
Wow.
So I think that, again, says a lot about video game music and where it's going and how much it's growing and the audience is growing. But in regards to, like, video game soundtracks as a whole, to, you know, as a game, you know, I really love the stuff that Nobu Uematsu did in Final Fantasy VIII. I thought that was probably one of my personal favorite soundtracks out there. It was just a very beautiful and emotional score that I thought really had some amazing music on it.
Kind of like this. Let's see here. It goes like...
There you go.
There you go. I was definitely into this in the Final Fantasy VIII when it came out, even though everyone loves Final Fantasy VII, but Final Fantasy VIII came out really good, especially in terms of music and all that.
Let the Final Fantasy VII fanboys have their...
let them have their moment of glory, but you know what? Final Fantasy VIII had... It was just as good as Final Fantasy VII. I will give it that.
I personally love Final Fantasy IV as the most favorite because it had a lot of dramatical motifs in the music itself. It set the tone for the story and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the characters and the story in VII were the best for me personally. You know, I thought there was a lot of, as for regards to the characters and story, but in regards to music, and yeah, you know, One Winged Angel is, you know, one of the greatest video game songs and this and that, but as a body of work, I think the music in Final Fantasy VIII was much better than in Final Fantasy VII. That's just my own personal thought, but...
Right.
I think VII is so popular because of the characters, because of the storyline, because of the PlayStation, you know, and the time that it came out and everything, you know, and the cinematics were beautiful and everything. But in regards to music, I go with VIII.
All right. All right. Now, how does the process of writing for a video game differ from writing, like, a movie soundtrack or a symphony?
It's very different, a different approach altogether. You know, movie music, to compare movies and video games for a second, you know, movies are all about telling a story and dialogue. You know, so when a film composer sits down and and works on a film or a television show or what have you, you know, a lot of times he's trying not to get in the way of the dialogue, you know, because that's what, you know, those mediums are based around talking and story. In video games, however, so to finish that thought, you know, a lot of time movie or television composers have to write a lot of background music, you know, under talking. But in video games, where action and interactivity are the main purpose in entertainment, you know, we as video game composers, I like to call what we do foreground music. You know, we're in show. We get the action scene almost every time. Whereas in a film, you know, any film composer will tell you the best time, their most fun parts, enjoyable stuff is when they do the main title theme and then maybe the chase scene or whatever in the films. You know, that's when the music gets a chance to take over. Well, in video games, it's always taking over for the most part, you know, and so, you know, we approach game music a lot differently for that reason, is that, you know, we get the fun parts all the time, and that's why you see a lot of film and television composers are now doing video games. You know, it's more you know, it's more of a fun kind of thing for them to do. But you know, the other difference of course is the interactivity, the interactive elements of it all. So for example, and we're not restrained, you know. For example, in film, you know, even the great John Williams has to sit down with George Lucas, and George Lucas says to him, okay, at 40 seconds, the music has to change here because Darth Vader just walked through the door. And then at this exact moment, the Death Star is going to blow up, so the music has to do this. So, you know, John Williams is restrained by that linear medium. You know, whereas with video games, a designer will come to me and say, okay, here's the deal. We got 100 guys on horseback, kick your ass, write me a piece of music. You know, so we don't have to worry about those things. But as regards to the interactive elements as well, you know, we might have to write an awesome song for 3 minutes, but then that same song, you know, how do we record it and write it or branch off when there's only 10 guys left who are attacking you, and then maybe 2 guys or 1 guy or no guy, you know, no people left. And then how is that score going to adapt and change and crossfade interactively while the music's going on? So, you know, so there's a lot of technical issues, a lot of creative issues as well. But and it's for all these reasons why I've always said that if Beethoven were alive today, he'd be a video game composer.
That's,
you know,
true.
He wouldn't
probably wouldn't be able to hear it, but
his music, like film composers have to deal with.
Now, what about I'm gonna bring up the subject of a game called Eternal Sonata, where it's all based off of Frédéric Chopin, and it's all done by live orchestra. However, it's a Japanese RPG.
Uh-huh.
And do you think that the concept of a game based on a composer would be doable, or?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, classical music is, you know, the most powerful. I mean, you know, powerful music ever written. I don't know if 300 years from now people are still going to be listening to Three Doors Down, but they're definitely still listening 300 years later to Beethoven and Mozart. So I think that says a lot about, you know, that music and that era and that power that music still carries today. You know, and I mean, I think there's you always have great combinations as well. A recent example from last year, for example, that had fantastic audio in it, and it had great sound design, but also it had great original music and great licensed music and old music, was the game BioShock. You know, BioShock, I thought, did it perfectly and won a whole bunch of audio awards last year for that reason. So, you know, just like film, you know, sometimes in films, you know, they'll use, you know, a Wagner's you know, Flight of the Valkyries, or, you know, Beethoven's Ode to Joy, Ninth Symphony, you know, so it really does, you know, it all depends on the scene and what you're, you know, what you're doing at the time.
All right, and let's see, you have any other questions, Maverick?
Nothing I could think of. I just wanted to say I've actually seen some of the classical scores mentioned on Burnout Paradise. And I think it's kind of funny how you have classical music mixed in with the crunching and twisted metal of Burnout.
Now, how has Victor Lucas been doing? And how has the Electric Playground and Reviews on the Run going on in Canada? And do you think there might be a chance that Judgment Day might come back here in the U.S. if G4 actually changes its mind?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if we'd even go on G4, but yeah,
we always got fused.
We were carried by many networks in the past, syndicated on, you know, we were syndicated on Fox and yep. WB, and we were on the Discovery Channel for a number of years, and MTV as well, on, you know, on different local levels and stuff. But yeah, I mean, but Vic's doing great. Electric Playground actually has so much content now that it's actually a daily show. Up in Canada, a daily half-hour show, EP Daily.
I need to still Canadian cable.
Reviews on the Run is still going once a week. Maybe you'll see it. The next thing we're doing now is we're in the process of doing now, actually, is putting all of the episodes on. So, you know, how about free to everyone? You know, that's kind of, you know, so we're just working through some distribution things and some contractual things that we already have in place. But the goal is to put all the episodes up online so, you know, people can stream them and watch them whenever they want.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Okay. And let's see. Now, were you self-taught, if I may ask, Tommy?
Yeah, it was. I learned to play piano and guitar, my two main instruments. I learned how to play by ear, and I don't know how to read or write music. So, you know, when people ask me who did I study under, I tell them John Williams and Beethoven and Mozart, because, you know, those are the guys that I, you know, listened to growing up. That's how I learned how to, you know, orchestrate and arrange for, you know, symphonies was through those. But, you know, if you talk about, you know, I also, you know, write a lot of rock and roll. So, you know, the influences that I listen to. So, you know, Aerosmith and Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and Boston and Van Halen and The Police and, you know, The Beatles and that kind of stuff, you know, influenced me in that style of writing. And then I also like, you know, some of the techno electronica trance kind of stuff. You know, BT is a good friend of mine, Enigma and Delirium, and, you know, some of those kind of you know, trancey type of things also influence as well. And I kind of put all those things together sometimes to create music as well. I use the orchestra plus the electronic and mix in some guitars. Now you're really talking. So, yeah, it really depends on the game. But yeah, completely self-taught, and just you know, just by listening to the masters, listening to all the great music that's out there. That's, and learning how to pick that up and play it on my own keyboard or guitar. Saying, wow, you know, listening to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony and going, wow, look what the woodwinds are doing this while the strings are doing that. And, you know, not just listening to it, but kind of deciphering it, you know. Wow, listen to what the choir is doing and while the cellos are doing that. And, you know, what are they doing there? And it's kind of, you know, that's how I learned how to write music.
Ah, now, a lot of people tell me that you need to go to college or to have a master's degree just to learn how to play music like you do. Do you think...
That's complete crap. Whoever told you that has no idea what they're talking about.
So, basically...
Ask Eddie Van Halen how many guitar lessons he took.
Yeah, really?
ask Jimi Hendrix.
Ask Angus Young how many good, you know, how many, like, guitar lessons.
You know, ask the Beatles how many music lessons they took. Ask Elvis Presley how many music lessons
really.
He took. You know, he created rock and roll.
and you're just another example of a person who just learned things by ear and got successful to where you are now.
Yeah, well, not nearly on the same level as any of those people, but yeah, sure. In the video game world, I suppose so, yeah.
All right, now, do you...
And that's not, by the way, that's not to say that, you know, going to music school and getting your master's degree in music is a bad thing. By no means am I saying that, you know. But I'm just saying that it is possible, you know, to be a composer and to be a professional musician without going to school. Obviously, any kind of knowledge helps, is good for everyone, you know. So, but is it a necessity?
I have a little bit of technical difficulties with Skype right now. It's what we're using.
It works, but no big deal. You still there, Tommy?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, good. All right. Okay. I got a couple of questions left. For those who don't know, the person, Don Fubar, what's his last name?
I don't know.
He's Sanchez.
Don Fubar Sanchez is up in Canada as Victor Lucas's co-host while Tommy is touring for Video Games Live. How's he been doing?
I don't know. I haven't seen the show.
He's been busy touring.
Jose is a funny guy. Jose was actually a fan of our show. He was like my moderator on my forums on Telerico.com.
Nice.
That's how he kind of met me and Vic. And always helped us out. So yeah, I kind of was unable to do it. He took up the helm. But I honestly don't know because I haven't seen the show. You know, because I don't live up in Canada, and I do get a lot of emails and MySpace and Facebook messages saying, "Please, Tommy, we want you back on the show." But I don't know what that means. So, but you know, I know that he's a great guy. He's a funny guy. I don't know how. I haven't seen the show, so I can't comment on it, unfortunately.
Well, what that means to the audience is to the fans.
That means we want you to rant about Japanese RPGs again.
I
miss those Pokemon rants.
We always had fun with the show, you know, and we obviously played it up a little bit. I played Bad Cop and
Good Cop, Bad Cop.
But I mean, you know, we pushed a lot of buttons. Well, I pushed Vic's buttons, but you know, we definitely pushed some buttons, and you know, a lot of people would get angry with me because of a certain review or whatever, you know. But you know,
let him be mad.
That's, I think people forget, and I think one thing that made the show great or makes the show great is that it's just our opinions. You know, I would never say to anyone, "Oh, I'm a professional game reviewer, and listen to me, and if you don't like the same games I do, then you're wrong." You know, I would certainly never say that. It's just my opinion, and I'm trying to entertain people, and you know, go over the top a little bit here and there for television purposes. But yeah, it's just kind of funny to me. You know, you get online sometimes. You know, you got your haters on the internet who are like, "He doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. How can he give this game a 7 when it deserves a 10? And blah blah blah. You know, it's like, you know, he shouldn't be allowed to review games. And you know, it's so funny. It's like, okay, well, make sure you send me a list of all the games that you love, so that I'll know how to review games. You know, you know, whatever.
So I'm sure
love,
to wipe
that's
and
all the games that I should give high scores to, and all the games that you personally don't like, I'll make sure to give those low scores so that you're happy. You know, I mean, so it is. It's kind of funny, the kind of stuff that the internet breeds. But you know, it's all in good fun, and I think for the most part, people understand. You know, that we're just having some fun, providing some knowledge. And I always say, you know what? You make the decision. Vic might love Japanese RPGs. I might not like reading 7 hours of freaking dialogue.
Yeah.
But that's not to say that other people won't enjoy that, and other people do like that. So, you know, I always say, hey, here's our opinions. Here's the gameplay. You make your own decisions. Hell, don't listen to us. What the hell do we know?
All right.
Exactly.
Now, we're about to wrap up here, but do you have any shout-outs or something else to add?
I mean, I would just tell anyone about, you know, to go to videogameslive.com, sign up for our you know, our mailing list. You can get online and look at our tour date schedule and everything, and you know, yeah, videogameslive.com. That's we're trying to go all over the world. So, well, we are traveling all over the world, but if there's a city on there you don't see that you want us to come and visit, just, you know, email us, info@videogameslive.com. Tell us where you want us to come out to, and please help us spread the word.
Well, actually, over here at KJCC, we are spreading the word to all the listeners out there. Go to videogameslive.com and tell them you want them to come back to San Jose, California.
Absolutely. We'll be in the San Francisco area next year, 2009. We're actually planning it right now, San Francisco and San Jose.
Oh, very nice.
I'll be there, definitely, especially with my Mario outfit.
Yes.
Awesome.
He's got, I swear, Tommy, he's got a Mario outfit complete with the mushroom plushie. It's great.
Awesome. Well, I got a full-on Spider-Man outfit, so maybe we'll have to, you know, put those on, and we'll go, like, running through the streets of San Jose one night.
That'd be nice. Kinda,
all right.
Run through Santa Clara Street.
But not on Halloween.
Oh, of course,
you know, just
not.
Like normally.
Well, all right, this is the end of the Limit Break right now. Once again, Tommy Tallarico of Tommy Tallarico Studios and the Audio Gang Company. I want to thank you again for giving us this opportunity to... what? Oh, yeah. One more thing we got to review, but Tommy, thank you very much for this opportunity to let us interview you.
It's been a pleasure. No, it's been awesome.
Well, thanks for helping to spread the word. I appreciate it as well. Thank you.
All right. Up next, we got ourselves a quickie.
A quick minute and a half review for all you guys who are saying, where's Maverick's review?
And we'll end on the Halo theme.
So just give us like a minute here, a second here. It's pretty good.
This week's review features Mario Super Sluggers for the Nintendo Wii. Princess Peach constructs a new island in the Mushroom Kingdom for all of her friends to play baseball in their own environments. Stadiums range from your average grassy baseball diamond to an urban intersection, an ice palace, a jungle sanctuary, an amusement park, playroom, and more. The party element is definitely here with a huge presence in forms of buddy moves and special plays, as well as the minigames. But that doesn't mean Nintendo came off with this game flawlessly. I did find a few flaws with controls and timing. At least one of the minigames is impossible to pull off due to the flaw. When playing the Piranha Panic minigame, the change in pitch doesn't read that well, and in the Barrel Blast minigame for Donkey Kong's Jungle, your hits don't read really well because the pitching machine is way too close to the plate. In the main pastime, however, the flaws mainly rely on the motion sensors in the Wiimotes, as the slightest movement will make the computer think you're trying to do a charged move, because the game does feature charged pitches and charged hitting. But this game's definitely made the party element known, and getting a team of 4 on the diamonds is a great way to go for this game. This game gets 7 packs of garlic fries out of 10.
...104.1 FM, KJCC, Real Campus Radio.
That was a great review. This is Maverick here. That was an awesome review. I'm so happy.
And this is Zoot, and this is Suzaku. I want to thank you guys once again for listening to our special interview, our special episode of Video Games Live. Up next is On the Spot and On Blast with your host, D-Money. Catch him next.
Later.